The Building Better Gamers podcast is a proud member of the MTG Cast Network. Get your audio fix on all things related to Magic the Gathering at mtgcast.com.
So I'm Kelly Reed. I am one of the founders of QuietSpeculation.com, which is a website for Magic the Gathering players who love to buy, sell, and trade their collectible cards. And I also am one of the now co-owners of MTGCast.com, which is a podcast network for Magic the Gathering fans. And it's a site that we acquired about a little over a year ago. And I am an entrepreneur and a gamer, a Magic player, and I now make my living running websites about games, and I think I have the best job in the universe.
Yeah, that's all pretty awesome. So I guess to start with Quiet Speculation, what triggered you looking at the financial aspect of the game?
Right. So I started the site in 2009. I had just spent a couple of years learning about finance and the stock market and that whole, you know, Wall Street industry, as you will. And at that time, I had also kind of just started, got back into playing Magic after a few years off during college. And this time, when I started playing again, I had actually just lost my job in the whole, you know, 2007-2008 fiasco. And Magic was just something I was doing, so I had, you know, something to do with my unemployed time. I had just moved to a new city, I didn't know anybody. And I just got back into Magic because it was a familiar port in this financial storm. And when I got back into Magic, I realized that a lot of the things I had learned in finance were really applicable to the way the collectible side of Magic operated. So at that point, there weren't a lot of the online markets weren't nearly as developed as they are now 5 years later, but there were still sites like Star City Games and eBay, and the market was still very robust, it just wasn't as efficient. And what I came to realize was that a tournament would happen, say, a Grand Prix, and the Monday after the tournament happened, cards that might not have been previously popular would get popular as a result of them being used in high placing decks. And then over the subsequent week, I would see that those cards would then slowly trend upwards in price. So my first foray into this was I bought 8 copies of a card that was popular at a Grand Prix. I ordered them on Monday, got them by, say, Friday, and over the weekend, I traded them all out for probably 5 times as much as I had paid for them. And being, you know, someone who was living basically like a broke college student at the time, the profit I made from that deal was, like, enough to buy me groceries, which was kind of an amazing moment when I realized that I just made, like, a Magic card trade that could pay for some of my life essentials. And at that point, I said, I think I'm onto something here. So I started writing about it and composing my thoughts online. I just started a simple blogger-powered website. And we eventually moved to WordPress, but we just kind of started talking about it to no one in particular. And I didn't have any readers in mind. I wasn't writing with a specific audience in mind. I was really just trying to organize my own thoughts in one place so I could go back over time and see how my theories would pan out. And after that, something incredible happened. People started actually reading it. I would put the link in my signature on forums like MTG Salvation and just said, hey, this is a place for Magic financial news. And people just kept coming. And after a while, we started getting linked to by other blogs, and we had people asking us to guest post on Quiet Speculation. And it really became its own little endeavor. And that's how we went from sort of nothing to being a relevant blog. The question of how we turned from a one-man blog into a business is kind of the second leg of the story. We, after a while, we had a few people asking us if they could guest post, which initially I wasn't sure if I wanted to let them do that. But after a few people, Corbin Hostler was our first guest poster, and he's still writing with us as a weekly columnist almost four and a half years later. We realized that all these guest posters were starting to form this core staff, and that the process of just approving and editing and spell-checking articles was becoming really time-consuming for me. You know, we had a growing readership that was demanding more and more content, and at that point, I had taken a job in retail, so I didn't have all the time in the world to run the site. It was clear to me that it was growing, and this was something that people really, really wanted. And so, probably, I don't know, I want to say a year in, I found a journalism student who was willing to sort of act as an assistant editor for me. So he'd be responsible for spell checking and making sure the posts go up on time and things like that. From there, I met Douglas Lynn, who at the time was a Star City columnist writing about legacy. He decided that he wanted to be a part of this because he was big into training as well. And we went through a number of interesting iterations of the business plan, like do we try to run advertising, and we had some meetings where we got embarrassingly low numbers for advertising from very wealthy companies. So we were like, okay, forget about it. These are people with deep pockets who don't want to give us real amounts of money. We looked at working with other people in Magic Finance, John Medina. You guys may remember him. He was a Star City columnist as well. Star City Games tried to buy us out at one point, which I can't really talk too much about, but we declined. And eventually we just said, hey, you know, there's only one way that we feel is the ethical way to get paid for disseminating this information, which is to simply charge a monthly fee for it. If we take advertisers, then we're beholden to what the advertisers do and don't want us to say. And I had encountered writing for other websites. I had encountered getting my writing censored because they didn't like that I was telling people not to buy certain cards. I won't name any names there, but the site was backed by a store. And when I wrote an entire article that was basically, here's 10 cards you don't want to buy, they were like, we're not going to publish this or pay you for your time. And so I said, forget about it. We have to stay completely independent. And then the only legitimate way to make money is to have a very transparent, fair trade with the customer. You give us money, we give you information, and we have nothing to sell you but a few points of view. So that's the long version of the short version of where QS came from.
So you told us about the different positions and you know, your team and what they do. So how does it all flow as far as like the dissemination of information and, you know, to actually showing it to your customers?
You mean like how does it go from, you know, how does an article get published or how does a piece of information reach our audience?
Yeah. How does it go from speculation to an article?
So we have about 10 insider writers. Insider is the name of our subscription package, the paywall. We have 10 writers that we have who feature long form columns on our articles section of our website. These are people who are generally active traders, active players, or some combination of both. And what they're writing about is their opinion. You know, we don't have one party line that we want people to adhere to. So they're going to use their corpus of knowledge and magic to determine sort of big picture trends in the market. Like Corbin recently wrote some stuff about why he thinks that modern prices are due for a rise in the near future. And he based that knowledge, that opinion, off of previous knowledge he had. He based it off of trends he's been observing. He'll use certain data sets, like data that we collect, data that he gets from other websites, and just information he gets by talking to people. And he just forms this sort of set of hypotheses. Like we did a video cast last week where he gave a few buy and sell recommendations on certain modern cards. For example, he didn't think Cryptic Command has a lot of room to grow, nor does it have a lot of room to drop in price. So that at first glance seems like kind of a non-opinion. But what it means is if you have Cryptic Commands and you're not playing them, which is the case with me, put them in your trade binder, front and center, and try to grind them for incremental value, because the act of holding onto them long-term will not get you anywhere. So it's less about speculation being like, oh, this card and that card are going to go up. It's more about what do you do with the assets that you have in the time that you're willing to spend. in terms of I'm willing to wait this long, and I'm willing to spend this much time, and spend this much time enacting transactions, and that's different for everybody. So really, we just try to give people 10 unique points of view on what on their cards and the market and the timing of the market, and it really. Like I said, there is no one party line that we're trying to sell. So it all just comes from the unique synthesis of each author's experiences and knowledge base. So when you get to something like the Pro Tour, for example, where we do, this time around, we did live video coverage where we had data on the screen and we had a few people live broadcasting on Twitch talking about what was going on in the tournament and what the financial implications were. Then that's sort of those people, seat of the pants, trying to make snap decisions with new information as it's being revealed. So it's a little more of an imperfect science, and we have one of our features of our subscription package is that we send out these real-time email alerts when important stuff happens. Like when, I'm trying to think of what's the best example of an insider alert we sent recently. Man, I'm really blanking on a good one here. There have been so many. Like, here's an example. This is a little bit old, but Huntmaster of the Fells was a card in Dark Ascension. It was kind of a low-priced mythic rare. But we have a pretty extensive network of people who have their eyes out for us. And on the morning of a Pro Tour Dark Ascension, we got tip that a huge number of professional players were running 4 Huntmasters in their deck. And now we can't really substantiate this by verifying it. We just have to trust our network of people.
Right, right.
But we know who we can and can't trust. And our emails are always pretty candid about the fact that we're going based on potentially sketchy information at times. And we're not saying, you must go out and buy all of these right now. We're saying, this is what we know. That there's a lot of pros on Huntmaster. And it doesn't seem like they're going to lose a lot of value anytime soon because they're already pretty cheap. And it turned out that Huntmaster was like the breakout card of that event. So the people who went in on those Huntmasters that Friday morning did very, very, very well. And so that's one of those times where it's not like we're having one author delve deep into his experiences, but we're just trying to be a magnet and a locus of information. And then likewise be that locus of information for people who need it. So we'll get it from all angles and then we'll redistribute it. So we have to play a sort of walk a thin line between what when we get a tip that we're like, this is shaky, or this isn't necessarily actionable. Because I've had people email me like, hey, I bought 100 of this card when you said to buy them, and that didn't make me money. And I have to go back and read the email and say, no, we didn't say to buy them. We stated facts that this card is in use in this deck. And if this result happens, and then that result happens, this card may have room to grow. And at no point do we ever say, you should buy this card right now, it's a no-brainer, you'll automatically make money. Like, if that's how the game worked, I would be in the business of only buying and selling Magic cards and I'd keep my mouth shut. Like, this is an information game where you have to make your own decisions for yourself. There are no correct answers. There's only who has good information, who has bad information, and who does the right thing with it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's cool because I don't know. I guess some people may have concerns that that this is more speculative than it actually is. And on a question related to that, what are your thoughts on the current state of MTG finance right now?
Oh man, that's a broad question. I'll talk your ear off if you ask me that one. Anything specific you want me to think about?
Well, I'm interested in a couple sides, but let's first talk about, I guess, on sort of a cultural, social level, because value now, trading is about value. It's more about value than it ever has been before. So, So. So what are your thoughts on that, on the current state of that?
The irony is that as more and more people start thinking about trading as a way to get value, the less possible it becomes. Like, eventually, it devolves into a zero-sum game. Like, it's completely different than it was in, like, 2009, 2010. You know, now everybody has a smartphone with 10 different apps that can look up Magic card prices. So that information gap is gone. People also are now much more aware of the fact that there are buy lists, which are verified merchants that will not only sell you their Magic cards, but will buy your cards from you in exchange for cash, which is actually the number that I look at when I'm trading, because that to me represents an instant turnaround, dollars for dollars. But without going into that, into those weeds, people who think that like trading is about getting value, you have to ask yourself at one point, what is your time worth? You know, are you going to sit there and grind? I did a trade a couple weeks ago where I traded a playset of a modern staple for a stack of like 100 plus cards, and the trade took 2 hours to complete.
Wow.
And yeah, seriously, and that's on me because I was being really thorough. I was only giving away the playset of the modern staples. But like, then after I spend those 2 hours, and then I spend the time to sell those to the buy lists or grind them in my trade binder, and I think I did the math that I'm gonna maybe make $20 an hour after that trade is all said and done. Now, that's not a bad rate.
It's not bad. Yeah.
It's not. But like, it's also, you know, you're not gonna make a great living grinding trades if you're only making $20 an hour here and there. But like, it came down to it. It was like, did I enjoy it? No, not really. Like, it was a slog. It was work. This wasn't like an incidental trade where it took me 20 minutes and then I did a quick flip. Like, this was, I was going to have to work for every penny I made there. And the other guy was not being like a grinder about it. He was really laid back and willing to do whatever. But if he had been like trying to grind me out in value, the trade never would have happened. He knew he was trading up into my big ticket cards, so he didn't really care. He was like, yeah, I'll get rid of all my dollar cards. I want your cryptic commands and your dark confidants. But like, people are starting to blur the lines between like what makes a dealer and what makes a trader and what makes a player. TCG players opening up to everybody as a selling platform has really blurred that line further. And the problem is that everyone now thinks that because they have their cards listed on TCG player that they can ask for dealer prices. And it's like, no, I don't think you get it. Like, you don't get to ask me for a discount because you have to pay marketplace fees. Like, that's your problem. My cards aren't worth less because you've decided to list on a site that charges you 15%. Like, people who sold their stuff on eBay never tried to pull that. And if they did, there were people who were power sellers with 10,000 feedback. People just, the idea of MPG finance in general has become much more mainstream. And if you look on, Google has this feature where you can search the relative popularity, or you can compare the relative popularity of search terms. And if you compare the popularity of MTG strategy and MTG finance, you'll see that no one was searching for MTG finance before about 2011. And now, in 2014, the search terms are approximately equal in terms of search volume. So that just tells you that more people are paying attention to what their cards are worth, which is good for Magic. But it's not necessarily good for people who want to make money by make a living going to Magic events and just trading with random people. The average IQ, the financial IQ of the average Magic player, is so much higher than it's ever been before. And that's because the internet has, and the Magic internet has evolved to the point where the information is so much better. There's so much more of it. I mean, quiet speculation is only one part of the puzzle. We can't take credit for this happening. Like, this was an inevitability as I saw it. Someone was going to do this. And now there's, you know, half the sites on the internet have people writing about finance, which is the way it should have been all along. Because finance is integrally tied to Magic as a whole. It was meant to be a collectible trading card game. It's always been that way. And only now, with the tools and the websites to support it, is it really coming into its own as a real market.
Going off that idea, do you feel there is any... your answer is already no, but do you think there is any concern that with all of this knowledge going out there, not saying that, you know, everyone being knowledgeable is a bad thing, but with everything being so transparent, are there concerns for some sort of, I don't want to say a bubble market, like a bust of some sort?
I think that there's always that concern. And I think that the important thing to remember when talking about bubbles and busts is that those are fueled by irrational exuberance, which we saw during Modern this year. We saw Zendikar Fetchlands hitting insane prices, and now they've fallen back down again. That was a bubble. That wasn't a huge cataclysmic bubble, but it was a bubble. It was fueled by irrational exuberance that these will never go down, and these are the most important thing to the Modern format, and this was long before the Khans of Tarkir fetches got announced. So I think that the overall sustainability of Magic's finance side is fine. It's healthy for the most part. I think we saw a lot of shakeout this year, too. I don't know how closely you follow the MTG Finance subreddit, but there was a lot of problems going on in there where people were just posting stupidity and vitriol, and you know, people were just trolling other people by posting threads like, hey, this card is spiking in price, when like they weren't doing good research, they weren't citing good statistics. They were saying, like, oh, it's sold out in Star City Games, that must mean something. And it's like, no, sometimes Star City Games just pull something out of their inventory temporarily for any number of reasons. I've asked them about this. Like, sometimes they need to pull 20 copies off their website because they're bringing it to a live event. Like, it doesn't mean that those 20 copies sold. It just means that they're now on sale somewhere else for a price that may be higher or lower. You have no idea. So you had all these people posting crap, and they were inflating prices on stupid cards for no reason, like Norn the Wary. Like, older cards, which aren't going to get reprinted anytime soon, which have some bizarre corner case of utility, and they would just go nuts. And people would then point to a site like MTG Stocks. The guy who runs MTG Stocks is a member with us for a long, long time. And all that site does is plot historical prices from TCG Player, which is the simplest thing in the universe. And, you know, you can make a graph say anything you want if you torture it long enough. And so just by virtue of the fact that a card that had low stock on TCG Player already, some chucklehead decided to buy up 12 copies of it. Like, and that's not demand. That's just a guy, that's a single actor making a single purchase.
Right.
Then all of a sudden someone goes, oh, they extrapolate that one event to the nth degree and say, and make a broad picture, sweeping generalization about the market based on that. And that was a real sort of reckoning. When people lost money because of crap like that, and I'm glad it happened. I don't wish ill on anybody, but I think that sometimes people need to lose money to understand what it's like to get screwed by your own irrationality and your own exuberance. People get really, they get like this, I don't want to delve too much into the psychology behind this, but I've read a lot about it, and that there's a real neurological change that happens when your brain is fixating on short-term potential gains. Like, your heart rate starts to increase, your adrenaline starts pumping. You know, it's like you're in the final leg of the chase against the deer you're hunting in the woods with a spear or a bow and arrow. And so you need that little extra push. But what it does is it makes you sort of, I don't want to say myopic, I guess. Like, you can only see the potential end result. You're not seeing what happens when you're wrong and lose money. You're not seeing, like, other opportunities that might be passing as well. You're not considering the long term. And it's shown to have really strange effects, like up to and including making you, like, less trusting of your spouse, like, which seems completely unrelated, but it's like it makes you less trusting of other people in general, because you're like, oh, I don't want them to steal my prize. So it really screws with your head in ways that most people have no idea about. And that's something I'm really cognizant of, I should say, when I'm reading other people's Magic Finance writing and sort of watching how that affects me. And so I think a lot of that hit a lot of people this year with the frenzy around Modern and with the sort of commoditization of Magic information.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's definitely sounded like a wild ride for the past year.
It's been crazy.
So with all this craziness that I'm assuming is dying down at this point a little bit.
I think it is. I'm pretty sure it's calmed down a lot. Like, the people who just thought that this was, like, an easy, quick place to make free money, you know, were disabused of that notion quickly. They lost money, or they made some money and then stopped making money, and then they said, this isn't for me. And the people that have been doing this all along are now back to doing it the way they've been doing it. So, yeah, I think it's calmed down.
Yeah, so since it's starting to die down more, I guess people are starting to realize which voices are worth listening to. You know, the crazy people aren't suddenly creating riots and whatnot. Do you see prices and, I guess, profit margins, if that's how you want to think about it, do you see those things becoming more and more rigid as the game grows?
Yeah, so Khans of Tarkir has been a really interesting case study for this, because most people don't consider the maximum combined value of a set. Most people just have this illusion that a card is going to be worth some amount of money based on some intrinsic utility of the card. Like, Steam Drino is a very good card. so therefore it must be worth $5. But so is Rakshasa Death Dealer. It's also a very good card. And there are all these very good cards in a set like Khans of Tarkir. And there are also five rare mana-fixing lands, the fetch lands. They're also very good cards at rare. And these can't all be worth $5. These can't all be worth $10 or $15. Like, all the fetches are still $10-plus dollars on the retail side. Some of them are even $10 on the buy list side.
Wow.
But what happens is there's an equilibrium that is defined by how product gets released and filters through the system. Basically, a store can pay about $75, I'm rounding, dollars to their distributor to buy a booster box of the current set. They get a certain allocation of those boxes for as long as that set is in print. Now, what happens when the dealer can open a booster pack and, on average, get more than they paid in retail value for the contents of that pack? So, like, if at $75 a box, it's about a little over $2 per pack. If you can open a Khans of Tarkir pack and be guaranteed $3 worth of value... Now, if you're opening hundreds or thousands of packs, eventually the stats will even out for you. If you're opening two packs, you don't get the benefit of law of large numbers and evening the variance out. But what happens is, when you open enough packs, you get more in cards than you paid for. And then you can sell those for a profit and buy more packs, open them, and sell those. So now when everyone does that, they're just going to keep buying and opening packs. Then there's going to be so many of those cards on the market that necessarily vendors are going to have to cost-cut each other so that their copies of Siege Rhino and the Fetchlands are the ones that are selling.
Right.
And because the margins are so high, because they only paid, you know, the math doesn't necessarily work out cleanly, but, like, they're only paying $2 a pack, and they're getting $3 a pack, well, they can afford to discount their cards on the retail side until the margins come back down to what they're accustomed to. So naturally, the market's going to reach that equilibrium. So we had cards in Khans of Tarkir, like Dig Through Time, was selling for $10-plus dollars. That's not going to happen. Like, that card would need to be a 4-of in every standard and modern deck for it to hold that price tag past the first 3 weeks of release. Now, in the first couple of weeks of release, like, there is a true limit of supply, and there is a really sharp increase in demand.
Right.
But after that initial period, our studies have shown that there's about a 25% drop-off between pre-sale prices and 30 days after release prices. And I haven't looked at Khans yet, but I would suspect it's going to be a lot more. Just there are so many cards in Khans of Tarkir that were $2 or $3 that didn't see play in any single deck. And that's the baseless kind of speculation that no one really stops to think about. Like, no one went out and bought a bunch of Bloodsoaked Champions and said, oh, I bet this card's going to go from $3 to $5. But, like, the fact is that they're still not in any deck, and the ones that you opened during your pre-release and your first few drafts, like, I have a playset sitting in my binder that I could have buy-listed for $3 a month ago, and now I can't buy-list them for half of that. So that sort of price irrationality doesn't necessarily have to manifest itself on the scale of crazy, hype-fueled mass buyouts. It can just be overpricing every card in a new set a little too much because of novelty, because of the factors I just described, like increased demand, temporarily decreased supply. And part of what we kind of try to do in our work is explain to people that this happens, when this happens, why it happens, and what they can do to take best advantage of the knowledge. So in this case, we pretty much just said, listen, there might be one or two cards in Khans of Tarkir that have upside right now, but we don't know what they are, because everything in Khans is completely overpriced. So the entire set is going to have to contract by, you know, double-digit percentages, 10, 20, 30%, before it's, you know, back down to any reasonable level. And don't forget, we're going to be opening three packs of Khans in draft for another few months. And then we're going to be opening two packs until, what, late April,
yeah,
early May?
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of Khans of Tarkir cards that are going to be on the market is staggering. And the fact that people think that these rares that you can just open like candy can hold a $5 price tag is just false. People's mental models for how to price a given Magic card still aren't quite, they're not there yet.
Well, actually, maybe, is it possible that it has to do with the way, I guess, with the direction card designs have gone to? It seems like Khans has been a pretty influential set when it comes to the older formats.
Oh my god, of course.
Yeah. So I kind of want to say that maybe the economy of MTG was just not used to such a good set.
I completely agree. Magic players have this ability to see a card and evaluate it in a vacuum or in their own little universe, when in reality there are always more factors than you're considering. So, like, again, going back to Siege Rhino, that card is crazy powerful. You know, if that card had come out in 1994, it would have been the best card that you could have opened in the next 10 years. But this is 2014, 20 years later, and Siege Rhino is just a very good card. So Magic players look at Siege Rhino and they go, this card is crazy powerful, therefore it must be worth a lot of money. But Magic's bulk bins are now littered with cards that were crazy powerful and are worth nothing. Because the card's power in the vacuum means nothing. It has everything to do with where the card fits into the bigger puzzle of Magic as a game. With a standard legal card, its primary price driver is going to be standard, of course. But we've now seen that Modern is very much capable of propping up prices, sometimes more so than standard. Modern players tend to buy cards and keep them too, because the format doesn't ever rotate. So Magic players are not used to seeing a set as good as Cons. They're evaluating Siege Rhino as a 4-mana-cost creature. They're not taking into account that it's a 3-color creature, which severely limits its utility in a lot of cases. So again, that's just another cognitive bias that we as Magic players have. Like, oh, it's a 4-mana 4/5 and a 6-point life swing. That's crazy. That's got to be worth money. But it's like, you know, you're allowing yourself to think too highly of the card because you want it to be worth money. So, yeah, I think that we definitely have not fully aligned our mental compasses to the difference between a good card and a valuable card.
Right. And speaking of which, though, because right now it's us responding to how Wizards is approaching their design, do you think Wizards is... To what degree do you think Wizards is thinking about the financial aspect and how people will react to, I guess, their design philosophies and the degree of power levels of their cards now? Do you think... I'm sure they don't have an economist there, but do you think they're reacting to it and considering it?
Absolutely. I'm sure that they don't have a staff economist, but I'm also sure that there are a lot of really smart people there who understand economics. So their publicly stated policy is that they do not make any comment on the secondary market, which is good.
Yeah.
But we know that they pay attention to it because they have to make decisions about what to say, you know, what to put in Modern Masters 2 and what to reprint and what to put in box sets. And we know they have a reserved list, which is a comment that says, we're not going to reprint any of these cards because we understand that you've made financial decisions in the past based on the promise that we're not going to reprint these cards. So when it comes to designing new cards, I don't think that they're looking at Siege Rhino and going, oh, this is going to be an expensive card. I think they're going and looking at Siege Rhino and saying, people are going to look at this card and say, man, this is really powerful. This is really cool. I want them. So they're evaluating desirability, not financial value. And I actually talked to somebody who went to the coast over dinner about this once, and he said that they like that the secondary market exists because it, and that sites like QS and others exist, because it makes it clear that Magic cards are desirable and have long-term desirability. So they're not thinking about what the numbers are. They're not saying, is this card going to be worth a lot of money? Is this card going to be too expensive? They're saying, does this make the product that we're producing on the whole more desirable? And when you make a set that contains 5 fetch lands, you're damn right that's a desirable set. And you know, in our terms, that's a valuable set. Because desirability for Wizards of the Coast means secondary market value for Magic players. So if you can go and draft Cons for $15 and in your 3 packs, you have a half-decent chance of making your money back by opening a fetch land, in addition to whatever you might win, then that's desirability and thus value. When they're designing sets, they're thinking about that. They're thinking about, are people going to want to spend money on these cards? Are these cards going to have longevity in other formats? So are people going to buy a bunch of Cons cards, play them in standard, and then they rotate out of the format, and then they'll have the bad taste in their mouth going, well, now I have all these worthless cards that are useless in all of the formats. Those are no longer desirable. So they have to design for that as well. And when it comes to reprints, that's when it's kind of sketchy, because they understand that $200 Tarmogoyfs are not good for modern, but there's also not a lot they can do about that. Like, reprinting Tarmogoyf made it more expensive. Go figure. I've never seen that happen. I've never seen that happen in Magic before.
Yeah, that was insane.
So, yeah, they definitely take it into account. But I don't think they're doing any sort of, like, micro-level manipulation. They're really just working on this axis of desirability.
Okay, yeah. It's really nice to see, I guess, the interactivity between the designers and the audience. And it kind of, like, makes me wonder, how come there aren't other games, or at least not many other ones, that have such a, I guess, such a fully fleshed-out economy, you know?
Yeah.
Would you say there are inefficiencies to how finance is handled in other games?
So, I don't know enough about other games to say that they're inefficient. My assumption would be that they are, but, like, I've done some looking into other games. Yu-Gi-Oh!, Pokemon, the World of Warcraft trading card game. The bottom line is that most games are not set up to have a financial layer in them at all. Most games, you buy the game, and then you own the game, and it's done. And if you're just done with the game, you sell the game, and you get some amount of your money back. Magic is one of the very few games on Earth that has this sort of rolling, rotating set of pieces, where each piece has a discrete and variable financial value to it, with its own level of desirability, its own use cases, and so forth. So there's only a handful of games that can even say that they have that. And I think that, and I'm not sure if I actually agree with my own hypothesis here, but it's the only one I have right now, so I'll go with it, which is that Magic's player base is partially what enables it to be so financially robust. If you look at Pokemon, the people playing Pokemon are often not the ones making the financial decisions. Pokemon is mainly targeted to preteens and younger, and it's the parents who are making the financial decisions. Yu-Gi-Oh!, if I recall, is more of a middle and high school demographic. And again, most of the purchasing decisions are not being made by the player there. Whereas Magic, the wheelhouse for Magic is the 20s and the 30s.
Yeah.
Which, that, you know, your 20s is when you're first kind of becoming financially independent, and when you're learning about, you know, you have your own home for the first time, you know, apartment generally, and you're managing your own assets. And so part of the customization of the game is that you can customize whether or not you know, how much you do or don't spend on Magic. So I think that's the big one. And, like, most video games, like, I remember World of Warcraft had an auction house, and there were, like, fun things you could do on the auction house, but, like, you could still play World of Warcraft without ever touching the auction house. You can't play Magic without buying Magic cards. You're going to spend money on them, or you're going to, you know, trade cards for more cards, but at some point, like, money's going to enter the system. Someone has to pay for the cards that you have right now. I don't know, like, everyone asks me constantly, like, hey, would you ever start another version of QS for a different card game? And I usually say no, because, again, the player base, the disconnect between who's spending the money versus playing with the cards, and then the community. Like, I don't want to be managing a community of teenagers. But for so many reasons.
Yeah.
For so many reasons. Like, but, you know, I'm 30. I just turned 30 this year, and, you know, a community of 20, 30, and 40-year-olds is something I'm very happy to manage, because you're past that point where, like, you know, now you have a baseline layer of intelligence and experience as a human being. So, Magic is kind of a special snowflake in that regard.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of funny, on a related note, though, if I were to speculate myself, it seems like, based on what other companies have been doing, I'd like to think a few of these other games will eventually get to where Magic is, sort of. Maybe not at quite the same level, but it seems like that's going to be the case, because not long ago, Nintendo was talking about how they noticed a pretty big spike in their Pokemon video game sales for older people.
Hmm.
Suddenly, people who used to play the first and second generation, you know, suddenly just came up and now are buying the newer generation.
What do you suppose is driving that?
First off, they are becoming financially independent, like you stated before. I think another thing is they are starting to realize the older markets with some of their other IPs. I think it's, you know, by association that they managed to reel people back in.
Nice. I imagine they did a really good job of that, too. I remember what got me back into Magic was, so I quit after Fifth Dawn. I got kind of sick of the Arcbound Ravager decks, and I was I was finishing up college, and I was like, I'd rather be, you know, hanging out with my friends and, you know, doing the things that college students do than sitting around and playing dorky old Magic cards. And I'll eat my words for that for the rest of my life. But I quit, and then they did Time Spiral Block. And I missed Time Spiral entirely, but then someone bought me some Magic cards randomly. And then I started looking at Time Spiral, and I was like, oh my god, they brought back all these characters from, like, way back in the day, like Teferi and, you know, all the Mirage Block characters, and, like, the Stronghold Block character, or the Tempest Block characters, and the Urza's Block stuff. Like, they just brought it all back, and it just gave me this huge wave of nostalgia. And at that point, like, now I'm in my mid-20s, as opposed to my mid to late teens, and, maybe I have some spending money now, and I feel like a lot of people came back to Magic when they kind of started growing up, because they realized that the hobby that they thought was too expensive, you know, that $20 a week to spend on Magic cards was now almost, you know, trivial. You're like, wow, I'm a college student, and like, I work, you know, in the city. Like, I'll blow that much on a night at the bar with my friends, or going to sporting games, and all of a sudden, like, Magic didn't seem as cost prohibitive. And I think that's what. That tide really started to crest around Innistrad Block when it brought back old players who were like, wow, Magic got really cool, and they brought in new players who were like, hey, Magic is really cool. And both of those hit at the same time. And Innistrad was a lot like Khans in that regard. It was a really high-powered set. It brought back some popular mechanics like Flashback. The theme was really, really cool. Everyone loves zombies and vampires and werewolves.
Yeah.
And I feel like during Innistrad might have been one of the best-selling sets in recent memory. I don't have that data in front of me, but I think that's the same phenomenon you're discussing with Nintendo and Pokemon.
Another thing is you're talking about rotating formats. The Pokemon card game recently just created a secondary format where you can play a lot of the older cards now.
Really?
That's happening too. And
huge.
Yeah, it's not the most fully fleshed out format at the moment. A lot of people are really just playing their new decks and just going to those same events, but it's going to be interesting to see how that develops.
Yeah, that's great. That'll get a lot of people who have, you know, cards from 10 years ago off the shelf again.
Yeah, I'm hoping that they, you know, keep expanding it and adding more formats. And
that's a fun game too. I like that card game.
I would definitely play it.
My aunt is actually a judge. She really likes working with kids, and she's been in the fantasy and gaming world for a long time, so she's like, I'll become a Pokemon judge, why not? So she teaches kids how to play the Pokemon TCG now.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Taught me how to play. It's a fun game.
So can I get your thought on the state of the living card game?
Yeah, living card games are really interesting to me. For example, is there anyone specific that you're curious about?
The one I had in mind was Netrunner, because it has sort of a financial side to it, because there are, like, inconsequential rares and whatnot, and they also expanded into, like, draft packs, and they just announced that they're rotating. They call them data packs, but they're expansions.
Hmm. I'll be honest, I don't know much about the Netrunner LCG. But, so maybe you could give me, like, the 2-second overview of, like, why it's different from something like, you know, Ascension, for example?
Yeah. The thing about Netrunner is that it's a non-parallel type of game. The two players are playing two separate roles, and those roles are dependent upon their character or corporation that they represent, and then there's cards specifically for those characters or corporations. It's interesting. That game seems to be the living card game. And then a lot of the other games that Fantasy Flight are coming out with are following suit. And there just so happens to be a little bit of a financial side to it, because some of their core sets have only like one copy of a card. So someone who's really into Netrunner is probably buying like 2 or 3 core sets. And maybe, you know, taking a chance with the draft packs, because those have random cards in it too.
And so it sounds like Netrunner is bridging that gap between the traditional buy the box model,
right?
Where you buy the box, you get one of every card, or X however many, and there's no variability whatsoever. And with Magic, where you're basically buying into a random slice of a pre-known corpus of cards.
Right.
And the really interesting thing to me is that, like, Magic could very easily be an LCG. Like, there's just no reason that it couldn't be. And, like, Cube Draft is kind of like the Magic version of the LCG.
Yeah.
So, like, I built a cube where all the cards, where the summed value of the cards in the cube cannot exceed $10 buy list, which was a hell of a challenge.
Wow.
Like, yeah, it's you have to dig deep. But then certain cards just, you know, certain cards become all-stars in that format. And with something like Netrunner, it sounds like they're starting to blur that line, which I think is the way that's probably for the best. Like, the Magic model is great, but I don't know that if Magic started today with no precedent for anything like it existing, I don't know that people would go for it. I feel like it would need to be a little bit different. You know, I think that the people want a degree of ready-to-play right out the box. Like, in a completely different game, I'll talk about League of Legends, which is
right.
You know, an action game. It's as far from Magic as you can get. You can have a complete League of Legends play experience without ever giving their company a single cent.
Yeah.
I have spent exactly $10 on League of Legends, and I play the game probably an hour, 5 hours a week, 5 to 6 hours a week. Like, I'm not serious about it, but, like, I bought one skin for my favorite character once. But when you can spend so little money to get a complete game experience, all of a sudden playing this inane game of chasing down cards by just buying random booster packs, you know, throwing turds at a wall and hoping something sticks, just doesn't, like, it, from an external point of view, it doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
But being a Magic player for 20 years, I mean, I almost take it for granted. So the LCG is a great model because you can say, give us $30 and we'll give you a box of beautiful, high-quality game pieces which represent a complete game experience. And I don't mean complete as in it has everything, but I mean front to back, you can experience the game we designed
right.
without missing any element of it. You want more depth or more subtlety or more customization, that you pay for.
Yeah.
So that, I think, is a great balance between the two. And it sounds like I'm going to call it Netflix. They're having a lot of success, too, I'm told.
Yeah.
Netrunner is, I think they're doing pretty well with that. So, yeah, it's a good hybrid model, for sure. I love hybrid models of everything.
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, I interviewed a game designer for a card game he created called Advent Saga, and he's actually going for the hybrid model also, taking notes from both trading card games and living card games.
Nice. Good. Be eager to watch that develop. Like, you've got to have some... I actually was going through the game design process about 18 months ago. A few people and I had an idea, not for a game itself, but, like, for the framework that would make a financially successful game. And one of the things that was core to it was the element of chase. The problem with a game like Ascension or any of those other games where you buy them in a box is that once you've bought them, there is no more chase. There's no more unboxing thrill. You open it once, you get the cards once, and you play with them forever. You don't get the that sort of pack-cracking addiction, which, again, to not dip too much into the psychology of things, is something basically variable reward schedules. If you tell somebody I'm going to give you a dollar every day, then you're not going to see any change in their emotional state day to day. At first, they might be like, oh wow, a dollar, and then hey, a dollar, and then on third day three, it's like, hey, where's my dollar?
Yeah.
Day four, where's my dollar?
Yeah.
And on day five, it's just like, yeah, just put it in the back. I don't care. Like, it just becomes ingrained into what they expect. Whereas when you have Magic packs, not only are you opening them and it's like, oh, do I get a rare or a mythic? Which rare or mythic do I get? Do I get a foil? Like, there's all these little micro chases that you're doing. Oh, do I get the fourth copy of the fetch land I needed? Or, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
By having the reward schedule be semi-unpredictable, you keep people, you just gotta string them along. If it's too unpredictable or too variant, then they go, screw this. I don't, you know. If it's like, hey, you buy 1,000 packs and one of them's gonna have a $1,000 card and the rest of them is gonna be a swift kick in the butt, no one's gonna play your games. Likewise, if every pack has the same value card in it, people are gonna get bored. So the game that gets that right stands a much higher chance of sort of propagating its gaming genetics down the line. And it sounds like Netrunner may have a recipe for success here.
Yeah, I think so. So, comparing that to Magic, how do you feel about Magic's current buy-in? I guess you could say.
Oh, man. This is one of those times where I try to step out of the magic world and look at it from an ignorant observer's perspective. The buy-in for magic is crazy, crazy high, and it always has been. That's not a problem. If anything, that might be good, because a high buy-in keeps the quality of people higher. It's the same reason that we have our forums on Quiet Speculation behind the paywall. $12 a month is not a huge sum of money. But if you can't afford $12 a month, I don't particularly want you spouting off opinions about what other people should do with their money.
Yeah, that's...
Like,
that's
it seems a little bit harsh.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, the communities... I heard a very astute person once say that all open communities inevitably degrade or degenerate. So just having some gatekeeper mechanism in place to make sure that the people who are participating have some kind of, you know, skin in the game.
Right.
Not like I'm trying to discriminate against people who don't have money, but it's like, if you can't afford to pay $12, why are you participating in a forum where people are asking what they should do with $1,200?
Right, yeah.
Like, the buy-in just keeps Magic players invested longer and more seriously, and Magic is a complex enough game that relies on deep social ties and prolonged social ties, so that having a high buy-in up front is very, very good for the game. I think that Standard is a much harder sell to a newer Magic player than Modern. Like, if I had to teach somebody about Constructed Magic, I'd start them with Modern. Because your Modern deck, like, my only Modern deck right now is Blue-Red Delver, and that's because Treasure Cruise is amazing, and I want to play it as much as possible before it gets banned. But, you know, I can keep, even if it does get banned, I can keep that deck.
Right.
And that shell, and my 40 set of fetch lands, and my 20 set of, my 40 set of shock lands, and then some mishmash of fetch lands, and I can play Modern forever. And I can tweak the Blue-Red Delver shell to splash white for Path to Exile, as long as I have the right lands. So buying in Modern for probably $1,000 seems like a lot of money, but when I think of the fact that had I bought in when Modern was announced, which was, geez, that was like 2 or 3 years ago by now, and, like, amortize that cost over all the years I'm going to play Modern, that starts to look pretty reasonable.
Right.
And if you play Modern for 10 years and you buy it for $1,000, that's like buying one or two new high-quality board games every year.
Yeah, just about.
So, the buy-in for Standard kind of sucks. Like, it's tough because you have to explain to people, like, yeah, these cards are actually only going to be worth any amount of money for about 18 to 24 months. Tops.
So, is the buy-in technically getting worse over time, though? Like, just for Magic in general?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I think that the equilibrium we discussed earlier about the wholesale price of booster boxes versus the theoretical maximum value of a given set of cards,
yeah,
is going to keep the price of most Magic cards in the same range. Like, you know, we haven't had a deck like Callblade, which was, okay, you need 4 copies of $100 Jace the Mind Sculptor, 4 copies of $20 Stoneforge Mystic, and that's the only deck that's viable, and you better be really good with it. Current Standard is really diverse.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, cards in the $3 to $5 range that do the heavy lifting for you. So you don't need to go all in on one particular hyper-expensive card. Modern's a little worse for that, but, like, the thing that's keeping Magic's buy-in reasonable is trading. Like, you can convert cards into other cards. And the savvier you are, the lower the buy-in becomes. You can win a tournament, open packs, get cards, and trade those. Like, there are ways to offset the initial cost of Magic. Like, by winning and getting cards and trading cards, you can then liquidate your extra cards. And that's the thing about Magic, is that your cards are a liquid, or I can't say they're liquid, but they are one step away from liquid at any given time. I mean, we've actually gone to great lengths to make sure that's true. In our Trader Tool software, you can take a spreadsheet of your collection, dump it into our software, and we will pick it apart and then send it to the buy lists of a few different vendors. And when I say send it, I mean literally you press a button and it's in their checkout cart. And then you mail them the card and they give you money. So
nice.
Your cards are actually just money. You're renting them from the universe. And when you're done, you can cash them back out. So it's almost like you're lending money to the Magic community when you buy in, and you're taking that, you're cashing back in on that loan when you decide to buy out. But I don't think it's a problem. I think it's actually one of the strengths of the game.
That's, yeah, I could see that. I could understand that. If we could talk about MTGCast, how did you come across to acquiring it?
So MTGCast is a site I had known about for a long time, and I always wanted to branch out in terms of what QS was doing into other forms of media. And in the back of my head, I always looked at MTGCast and I said, man, I wish I owned a site like this. And I just kept, you know, I checked in here and there. And I forget how I actually came to know what the situation was. It might have just been something that they posted on their homepage. But the guys that were running the site, they were just at a point in their lives where they had more important stuff to do. Like, I think one of them had just gotten married or was about to get married. And the other one had recently a new father. And really, running a Magic card website was not at the top of their priority list. And once we talked it over with them, they were like, yeah, this site is not operating efficiently. It's not being run the way it deserves to be run. And they were at a point where they were like, well, we need someone else to run this or we might have to shut this down. Like, they were paying for their hosting costs out of pocket. Just a lot of stuff wasn't being done the way it should have been done, and they knew it. But when it comes down to, like, hey, do I optimize the Magic podcast website or do I, you know, go to my daughter's soccer game? Like, family wins.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm already, you know, in the industry. I'm already doing this. So it wasn't a big leap of faith for me to say, oh, I could do that for MTGCast as well. So I talked to Doug, who's my co-founder, Tyler, who is my sort of right-hand man, my content editor, and a couple of the other guys, Jason and Corbin, who are the guys from Brainstorm Brewery, who have been writing for us for a while. And I said, you know, basically we have the opportunity to take the reins of this site, and it will be ours. We will own it. We will assume all the costs, which are not, you know, when you're hosting gigabytes of podcasts every month, it's not trivial. And I said, you know, I don't want this site to go away. And I think it would be a valuable asset for us to have in our, you know, under our control. Even though it's not really, like, our main business, what do you guys think? And they were all very amenable to it. They all thought it would be great to have control over something like that, use it as a vehicle to promote the Quiet Speculation brand to some degree, but mostly just as a way of... part of it was just like, you know, if not us, who? Who's going to take this site over? Who's going to pay the hundreds of dollars a month to run the servers? Like, the site doesn't really make money. Like, it's not a commercial site. It's there.
Yeah.
Like, we put a few things on there where, like, if you host your podcast on there, we ask you if you'd like to pay us a monthly fee. But if you don't, we're not, like, there's no consequence. We're just like, hey, would you like to help offset the server costs? Because otherwise you're going to be paying to host this somewhere yourself. But if you don't or you can't, that's fine. The point was always to give any Magic player who wants to produce a podcast of, you know, at least decent quality, a place to, you know, get their voice out there and get heard. And get some publicity, and that continues to be the mission. And we're looking at ways to make a little bit of money from the site here or there. But we'll be happy when the site's breaking even, and we're not net losing money from the Quiet Speculation bank account to
write.
But that's if it's it's in the scheme of things, it's not a lot of money. It's for what we're getting, or what the community is getting. The site is run by volunteers, people who care about it and who care about the mission, and there really isn't a lot to say about it, honestly. It is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm glad you guys... I think it's very important for the community in general. I think there's history there.
Oh, yeah. It's been around a long time. I think it's like 8 years or so.
Yeah, something like that. So.
Yeah, we're definitely cognizant of that. We couldn't just let it fade.
That can't just disappear on us. I mean, I would ask, like, what would you want to do, but I guess you guys are still trying to figure that out.
As far as monetizing it, you mean?
Yeah, that. Maybe integrate other forms of media or something like that, or just different takes on MTG-related content.
Well, right now, this isn't necessarily MTGcast-related, but on QS, we're starting to experiment with live video and Twitch.
Yeah.
Because I played Hearthstone for a little while, and I really liked that game. I kind of got bored of it, honestly. It lacked depth. But what I noticed is that people really liked watching other people play Hearthstone. And I didn't find that to be true with Magic. I don't even like watching other people play Magic that much. I don't know why that is, but, like, Hearthstone is so much more simple. It's much more fast-paced. there's like, it's the same reason I think people don't like watching chess. I don't want to watch some guy scratch his beard for 10 minutes thinking. And like in Hearthstone, that just, if you do that for more than 30 seconds, like a little lit fuse starts ticking down on the screen and the music starts getting ominous and your turn ends when the fuse explodes. Like, that just doesn't happen in Magic, especially Magic Online, where you can just let your timer run down for 10 minutes on one play. But we thought, you know, people love thinking about and talking about and learning about Magic cards. Why don't we try, like, the talk radio format, but with live video? So what we did was we used the software we already had built, and we sort of combined that with the software that people use to do the live streaming for other games, and sort of, so I sort of started producing this sort of CNBC style, or is that the financial channel? I don't like, well, I don't really watch a lot of TV, the tickers and the graphs and the junk like that. So we started producing like a CNBC style visual overlay that we could all get on Skype. And like most recently it was myself and Doug and Adam Yurchik, the pro player, TCG player and QS columnist, and Corbin, who is, you know, one of QS's columnists, Brainstorm Brewery, and now does coverage writing for Wizards of the Coast on the Pro Tour. And we just got around the digital campfire, went through a list of modern cards, which I had up on the screen with prices and images and other sort of data like that. And we went through and just discussed them, buy, sell, hold, what do you want to do with them. And people, we got a lot of really positive feedback from that. People really liked the format. And the good thing is, too, that it translates without the data overlay. It works just as well as a podcast. So that's one of the media, the mediums, I can never get that one right. Yeah. That's one of the media that we are really having fun experimenting with. I think that MTGcast is going to stay podcasts for now, just because I don't see a real depth of amateur-produced Magic video. And I don't mean the term amateur insultingly. I just mean, like, most Magic podcasts are done by passionate amateurs for no reason other than the fact that they want to.
Right.
And that's just not as common with Magic video. And besides, there's already a site for that, and it's called YouTube.
Yeah, that's true.
It's the second biggest search engine in the world, and it really, I don't think that it needs to, I don't think Magic players need something that caters to video right now. You know, we do our live stream on Twitch, and then when it's done, we publish it to YouTube, and we link to it on our main site, and that's, you know, we can embed the video. But with podcasts, like, there isn't really a YouTube of podcasts. They're all kind of fragmented by vertical, and so MTGcast is that particular shard for Magic.
Right.
And I think that's its role. As far as monetizing it, like, we don't want to make it too complex. We really like the idea of just like a patronage model, where if you are a listener and you download lots of podcasts from us, it would be awesome if you would be willing to support us by giving us a one-time or recurring payment. It's the same thing if you're a podcast host, if you're using our hosting services. But ultimately, I want it all to be voluntary. Like, client speculation is pretty cut and dry. Like, you want what we sell, you pay us the money. With MTGcast, I would like it to remain the opposite, where this is what we're doing, we're giving it away 100% for free, pay what you wish. So who knows if that will ever get us to the point where it's profitable, but like I said, the real goal is to make sure the site continues to exist under the helm and command of people who cared about it, and everything else comes second.
Since you're taking care of that and you're doing Quiet Speculation, do you have anything else coming down the pipeline? Do you have any projects in mind or something that you would like to do eventually?
Oh, man. You mean with, like, Magic or gaming, or like in life in general?
I guess in general, yeah.
I have this dream of one day buying a used motorhome and living in it full-time and traveling around the country. Not very gaming-oriented, but it's just I've had serious wanderlust, and I love exploring, and I love adventuring, and I love not having plans, which is partially why I'm so attracted to entrepreneurship. You know, it's very much the same sort of meandering path, where if you turn left one day, as opposed to right, the entire landscape's going to be different for the year that follows. But I'm going to stick with QS for a while. I mean, this site's only 5 years old, and I think it's got, you know, it's got another 5 to 50 years left in the tank, and I think there's a lot more. You know, there's 13 million Magic players in the world, and I can't tell you how many of them subscribe to my website, but I'll tell you that it isn't all of them.
Yeah.
Or else I'd be doing this interview on my private island somewhere. But we're doing very well. I'm very happy with where we're growing. But, you know, we can always reach more people, and we can always bring the message of being smart about your Magic cards, about the value of your Magic cards, to more people. And really, I don't think I want to pick up another business project until we've really exhausted the market for our current product. I really think we have a great product, and it's only getting better. We have a lot of interesting features coming up that I'm not really at liberty to talk about, but things to do with more in-depth data analysis and historical prices, for example. We just launched a feature that lets our writers and our editors submit their rating on a card, i.e. buy or sell, and then it does a little bit of fancy math to combine all the ratings and figure out, you know, the consensus among our experts, is this card a buy or is this card a sell? Because we think that so much of Magic is moving towards tools and websites that tell you in great, great excruciating detail what's already happened. Where it's like, you know if you missed the boat on buying a hot card, you don't need a graph to tell you you screwed the pooch on that one, you know?
Right, yeah.
So what we're trying to do is, like, there's no algorithm that's going to predict the price of Magic cards. I know people who are trying, and to them I say, good luck, Godspeed. If you figure it out, I'll be the first one to pay for your service. But I think that the best algorithm is getting 10 of the smartest people you know in a room and taking some mathematical averages of their opinions and seeing where that goes. So that's something that we're experimenting with right now. You can see the initial feature of that on our site. When you look up any card, you'll see expert ratings. And I'm excited to see where that goes, for sure. I'm still getting our rating staff accustomed to how to use the system, but like when we did that video cast recently with Adam and Corbin and Doug and I, every time we talked about a card, we would go into the software and each submit our ratings. And then, you know, if we disagreed, then the software would actually recognize that there was disagreement and throw, you know, we'll tell the reader, hey, this is something that the staff doesn't agree on. Or if we agree, then it'll say this is a buy or this is a sell. So just experimenting with, like, how can we condense information into a way that people on their smartphones trading can get the most information on one screen, like giving them the buy price, the sell price, and then, like, our expert rating goes a long way towards bridging that gap. But yeah, QS is it's my baby, and it's going to stay that way for a while.
Sounds like that could work, taking all that data and making it as digestible as possible so that all they have to do is just pay for it, and it's right there.
Yeah, exactly. And like the more value people can get out of the cards they already own, and the more money they can save buying new cards, that's better. It's good for the game.
Yeah,
people,
that's true.
If you can play more Magic for the same amount of money, or more Magic for less money, then that means you're going to play more Magic in general and spend more money because your money is going further. And ultimately, we have a very hard line stance that if it's good for Magic, it's probably going to be good for us too.
I guess if you have anything to add, you can say it.
On the topic of building better gamers, we just published an article today that compares cheating in the game of Magic to some of the things that people do in trading Magic cards. And it's actually behind our paywall right now, but a few people have requested that we actually make it free, so I think we're going to. The crux is, if you're playing a game of Magic and you conveniently notice that your opponent has your life total written down wrong, and it's maybe a little higher than it should be, and you go, hey, what life do you have me at? And they say 15 when you're really at 12, and you go, oh, okay, and just kind of write that 15 on your pad, that... Would you agree that that's cheating?
I mean, yeah, by definition, it's...
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I mean, I don't know that anyone would disagree with you.
Yeah, right.
I mean, unless you think you screwed up legitimately, but like if you're like, he gives me a 15, hey, you give me a 15? Okay, cool, yeah, right on. No, I must have just wrote a 2 instead of a 5. That's cheating, and your opponent may never know, and then when he loses the match, then, you know, he's still, you know, the outcome was the outcome. He doesn't feel cheated. So what's the problem, right? No, that's still cheating.
Yeah, right.
But yet, when we trade with people, on some level, we think it's okay to work this knowledge gap. And the example the article writer gave was, he said, you're trading with a guy who's got a foil birthing pod, who hasn't really thought about the card since it was legal and standard, and it was $10. It's a $30 card. And when you ask that of the guy, what do you value your foil berthing pod at? All you're doing is fishing for an opportunity to let that person screw themselves. You know what it's worth. Like, there's a number that you have in your head that is how much this card is worth. Or you may have two numbers, which represent a range. For me, it's the buy price and the sell price. And, I take those both into consideration. But, like, still, when you're asking somebody, what do you value this card at? What do you got that at? It's like, why are you asking that? You're just asking that to give them a chance to screw themselves so you don't have to do it to them. And thus you have plausible deniability that you didn't do something wrong. Like, I think we're going to hear a lot more about that soon. And it's something that I think that people who read Quiet Speculation, write for Quiet Speculation, or work for the site all have had to contend with at one point or another, is this illusion that if you are trading and you're serious about trading, then you have to be a shark, and you have to be dishonest, and you have to be survival of the fittest, always out for blood. And that's just not the case. And there are ways to make money by profiting from information disparity, but not on the most basic level. Like, if you and your opponent, I shouldn't say opponent, you're your trade partner, want to go buy a specific site's price guide, like, I think it's very reasonable if two people are trading and they want to use TCG Player Mint. That's fine. Or if they want to use Star City Games, that's fine. As long as it's not, as long as, like, one person isn't knowingly using an out-of-date price guide, like, to screw the other guy, as long as you're both using the same reference, that's fine. The way I, and I'll be very transparent, the way I make money without trading is I look for cards whose TCG Mint prices are very, very close, where the buy list prices are off. That's not dishonest. I tell people I'm doing it. I'm like, because these people aren't, the buy list price only matters if you're trying to cash your cards out.
Right. Yeah.
And if I'm trading for cards, it's generally to fill a hole in a deck, at which point I only care that I'm not losing money. I'm fine trading one for one. But if I'm trying to, like, I bought a collection and I'm trying to grind through the cards I'm not going to play and get my collection, my nut back, I'm going to trade for cards that are worth more on the buy list than the ones I'm giving away, because I'm not taking advantage of anyone there. I'm taking advantage of the fact that my cards and his cards have different destinations. The cards I'm giving the other guy are going to go into his deck or his binder. He doesn't care what they sell for cash, because he's not going to sell them for cash. Likewise, he doesn't care what... I don't care what the retail price of the card is, so long as I'm not using that as a tool to be dishonest with somebody else. You know, if the retail price on the card I'm giving the guy is higher, and the buy list is, you know, and the buy list is favorable for me, I can use that to make up some more profit, but I can also use that as an opportunity to be a gentleman and be like, hey, it's only a dollar, don't worry about it, and build the goodwill.
Right.
Now, the final thing is that Magic is a really, it's a deep community game, and because the buy-in is so high, as we discussed, the community aspect is that much more magnified. So, really, the saying of you can only skin a sheep once, but you can shear it many times, it's really applicable here. Like, finding somebody who you are comfortable trading with, who will not screw you over, and vice versa, is great, because you can just keep going back to that well. And the best is when you're trading with somebody else who's also a big deal trader, like, they're used to doing high dollar deals, moving high volumes of cards. Like, and when I used to do this professionally, like, we'd go to big events and we'd meet up, and people would be like, oh, man, you guys are just two stores. This must be, like, butting heads. It's like, no, this is the easiest thing in the world. Because the first thing we talked about was we explained our business models to each other. I'd say, hey, I'm looking to take my dual lands and trade them down into things that are going to buy list for a little bit more money. And the other guy's like, yeah, I need dual lands for my display case in my store. Done. You know, 2 hours later, we've moved thousands of dollars in cardboard between hands, and no one feels any worse off for it, because we've identified each other's goals, and the whole process has been very transparent and very respectful. I feel like that is something that is lacking in Magic trading these days, and I just hope that more people come to realize the value of community and repeat business, repeat transactions, even if you're not in this for the money.
I'm kind of surprised that is still going on, because everyone has a smartphone, and that type of scarcity mentality is just outdated now.
It really is. Well said. I mean, the thing is, the smartphone thing only matters if you use it. Like, I know people who will be intimidated by, a more experienced player, and we'll just let them name numbers under some assumption that there is going to be fairness, which is fine, you know, trust but verify. If I have no problem, I don't want someone to look up every single card they have. I think there is some courtesy that you have to have, like, knowing what your cards are worth. But, like, if you don't know what something is, if you don't know what any of your cards are worth, don't trade. Go home, spend an hour, look up every card you own, print them out, make a list. There are lots of softwares that will do this for you, including mine. But, like, you have the responsibility to yourself to know what your stuff is worth. You wouldn't go to a used car dealership and try to sell your car and just, like, hope that the guy gave you a fair offer. If the guy realized you had no idea what your car was worth, you brought in, like a vintage BMW, and he offered you, you know, a few grand for it, and you were like, oh, I don't know, is that fair? Like, of course you don't know. You didn't do the research. You don't deserve to get a good deal here. But you don't deserve to get screwed. You deserve to go home and do your research. Like, the tools are there. And if you're a level of intelligence where you can shuffle up a deck of magic cards and play a game, you are smart enough to use the internet to look up the price of a magic card. There's no excuse for ignorance, but there's also no excuse for taking advantage of ignorance. The opportunity to teach doesn't always reveal itself to people. Like, the opportunity to tell somebody, hey, yeah, that birthing pod foil you thought was 15 is actually closer to 30, and here's why, and here's how I found out. And when you do that to somebody, and it's funny, sometimes people will be like, oh, wow, I'll tell you what. I'll still trade it to you at 15, though. I just really appreciate you being honest with me. And then, like, then now you've made a friend. And now you've made a trade partner who will probably want to do business with you again. So the margin you lost by being straightforward with somebody, if you even lose it at all, will pay itself back over the long term. And so remember how I said the psychology of gains and victory makes you myopic?
Yeah.
That's the exact same symptom. You don't see the long-term effects of doing the right thing in the moment because you're so focused on the money you're not going to make that it never crosses your mind to think, well, you know, I did the right thing and this will come back around. And maybe it won't, but like you still did the right thing regardless. It's tough to sell that to people who are still have the mindset that, like, MTG finance is survival of the fittest. But, like, I hear people say that all the time. It drives me nuts. Like, the fitness function that you use to evaluate fitness in Magic is community. It's the strength of your bonds. It's not, you know, how much... It's not your gross margin on every single deal.
Right.
But, and I can just rant about this for a long time, so I'll leave it at that. Like, the fitness function for survival in Magic is not raw profit. It's repeat business,
right,
and trust. It's like you have people who come to you because they know you. The guy who text messages you that you haven't heard from in 2 years and goes, hey, you still buy magic cards? Of course I still buy magic cards. Man, is money still green? That's why. Why? Because when I traded with that guy 2 years ago at the game store, I was cool with him and I was nice and I didn't screw him and I introduced myself and I shook his hand and I valued his cards fairly and I told him how I was valuing his stuff and my stuff and I acted like a professional. And so now he's going to treat me the same way. He's not going to keep me at arm's length and, like, only call me as a last resort when every other game store in town has no-sir'd him on his collection. So,
yeah,
that's my rant.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to realize that doing these, like, hobby-based finances is a true investment, not in just a liquidating sense.
You're not just investing in assets. You're investing in yourself and in other people and in the community.
Right.
Absolutely agreed, man. Absolutely.
Yeah, this game is going to be around for a long time. There's no point in acting like you need to get your money and run.
No, you do need to get your money and run. Sell all your cards and just go to the weekly draft. And if you don't want to stay invested in the cards for whatever reason, that's fine. But don't sell out your reputation because you can always, if you sold your Black Lotus in 1993, you can still buy one back today. It will just cost you more.
Right.
You sold out your reputation in 93. You probably still can't buy that back. Like, there are people whose names I hear, and I'm like, oh, that guy's a scumbag. Like, I literally haven't thought of that guy in 10 years. And it's what did that dude do? He probably, there's one guy I know who, like, stole a dual land from me once and then denied it. And, like, to this day, nothing you could tell me about him would make me think, hey, that guy's a lying piece of crap.
Wow.
Because I know he stole a dual land, and, you know, cool, man, that was 1995. I'm glad that almost 20 years later, I still think you're a piece of crap. You cannot, no amount of money will fix your reputation. Ask a politician.
It's kind of a scarier thought now because, you know, the world's only getting smaller.
Dude, there was a conversation on Facebook where some dude went into the whole survival of the fittest thing, and what he failed to consider was the fact that it's the guy, he was bragging on Facebook about ripping somebody off. And it's the guy that you ripped off might not even have a computer, let alone a Facebook account. But he knows other people who do, and they know other people who do. And eventually, someone's going to make that connection, and it's going to come back to him. And even if he never meets you again, he may say something to someone else about the time that you ripped him off. And all of a sudden, now maybe the guy that you trade with at F&M isn't as keen to trade with you this week, and you have no idea why. And you will never know why, because it will never be clear to you that some information trickled through some back channels and was misconstrued the wrong way. The one thing you say on Facebook is there forever, it's permanent, and you now have to live with that fact. I feel like everything that goes online should be considered known by everyone and permanent. And you're lucky if neither or both of those things are true. There's no anonymity. If you say something in public on the internet, pretend everyone right. knows, because it's only a matter of time before that yeah. becomes true. So, again, the community in Magic is also really an amplifier there. It runs deeper.
Yeah.
Magic players also have the sense of justice. If you rip somebody off and you brag about it, some people are vindictive enough to go out of their way to make sure that the people you ripped off suddenly know who you are. And, and that gets scary, too, when you have people who've decided that they're crusading against you for whatever reason, for valid reasons or otherwise. So it all comes down to the fact that you need to be transparent and honest and the consummate professional in your dealings, because that way no one ever has anything on you. The easiest way not to have any, to keep people from having a grudge against you or to keep people from having dirt on you is to just not have anything grudge-worthy or dirty about you. Easier said than done. We've all got things that we prefer hadn't happened or we hadn't said, but that and an apology also goes a really long way, because that travels quick too. Contrition travels very quickly on the internet as well. Someone screws up and then they say, that was really stupid of me, I'm sorry. That can go viral just as easily as somebody opening their mouth when they shouldn't have in the first place.
Right. Yeah, it's very important that everything is, out in the open, upfront, and honest. In the same token, it's amazing how many things just blow over so quickly, because the truth is just out there and there was no resistance to it. And I think, a lot of people are growing up to understand that, just because you said or did something stupid on the internet once doesn't mean that's always going to be you. It doesn't have to be anymore, because the internet's just so fast-paced.
And it's also, everything is time-stamped. If you say something really, really objectionable on Monday, and then you say you apologize for it on Tuesday, and then you say something nice on Wednesday,
it's like it never happens sometimes.
People are going to look back and go, yeah, that person is human.
Yeah.
People say stupid stuff sometimes. My co-founder, Doug, always says sunlight is the best disinfectant. I completely agree.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I just wish more Magic players would, we had the Rookie of the Year get his title revoked because he was a cheater. How miserable for the game. That just needs to stop, and I don't know what will stop it, but at least that people who are doing these things are getting caught. And people are seeing what happens, that, they're getting banned for, I got banned for 4 years or something. Ban them for life.
Yeah, at this point, I'm kind of surprised.
I don't want him back.
I am very, very surprised that there was a time limit this time. Especially when you realize how heinous it really was. Some of his previous things were kind of maybe they could have been mistakes, or could have, they could have been a little bit of gray, but yeah. This time it's no, that's a bit much.
I mean, you're stacking your opponent's deck so they lose games. You have no business being anywhere around this game ever, and I don't think anyone in the world will ever miss you. So, there's always going to be dishonest people, and as a community grows, there will be more of them, but it's up to the people who are honest to be the checks and the balances that keep an eye out. I read a great article with a bunch of photos of Tom and Cheat.
Right, right.
And the thing that I'm always worried about is, like, I am, as a Magic player, I am deadly honest. Like, I will not let my opponent misrecord life totals or anything, but I can be forgetful. Like, sometimes I crack fetch lands and I forget to write down, and it's more my opponent's fetch lands and I just forget to write down the damage. So it's like, the article had just like 10 different ways you could be a tighter player and avoid, like, basically accidentally cheating or allowing your opponent to accidentally cheat. Stuff like, when you play a land, if, you know, for your turn, play it upside down so that you don't have to ask yourself or your opponent whether or not you made a land drop. Like, this is weird to say out loud, but, like, I'm sure that there has been a game in a tournament in Magic where I have played a land when I couldn't have played a land. Like, it's inevitable. I've been playing for 20 years. I'm sure there has been a time where I screwed that up. And had I been aware of it, I wouldn't have done it. But, like, Magic is a really complex game. Like, I'm sure that I have let an opponent attack me with a summoning sick creature before. So now my Young Pyromancer triggers, I put my tokens that are summoning sick upside down. You know, when I have a Delver trigger, I put a die on top of my library. Things like that, you know, just ways to keep yourself honest and to show your opponent what you're doing to keep yourself honest. I hope that translates to the opponent's play too, that they'll do things to keep themselves honest. I think a lot of cheats come from honest people being given the opportunity to be dishonest. That's a big one. Like, it's one thing if someone sticks you up with a gun in the street and asks for your wallet. It's another thing if someone sees your wallet just kind of sitting unattended on the table and walks off with it and just kind of doesn't give it back. They're both stealing, and they're both wrong.
Right.
But one of them was a crime of opportunity, and one of them was a crime of intent. And in my mind, they're worlds apart in terms of why they happened, but the end result is still the same. Like, you did the wrong thing, and someone else is going to suffer because of it. So all of these little ways that you can sort of demonstrate to another person that, like, this is the standard you hold yourself and other players to, I think that goes a long way. When my opponent isn't writing down life totals, I tell them, go get a pen and some paper and write down life totals. Like, those dice, when that Shufflehead next to you top decks the win as Windmill slams his card and those dice fall over, and all of a sudden, I'm the only one keeping life, and then I miss the fetchland damage on one side or another. Now, neither of us are representing the accurate game state. Like, you gotta hold people to that standard of procedural honesty. Same with trading. Don't ask people what they value their card is at. Don't say, hey, what do you want for this? Like, what do they want for it? They want the same number you want. You want to get for your cards. The price.
Right.
Like, there is a number. Agree on it. Hold people to those standards, and I think that just doing that will keep the game a whole lot cleaner.
Yep. Well said. If people wanted to contact you and look into your websites, where should they go?
QuietSpeculation.com is our main site, and if they want to contact me directly, they can just shoot me an email, kelly@quietspeculation.com. There's also mtgcast.com for Magic Podcasts. So if they have any questions about QS, what it is, what we do, take a look at the site, or just shoot me an email. We're on Twitter @QuietSpec. We're on Twitch @QuietSpeculation. We're on YouTube @QuietSpeculation. And probably every other internet service @QuietSpeculation as well. But I don't think we're on Instagram. I don't think we're cool enough.
Not yet.
So I feel like we're over 30. Instagram is for the youngins.
I guess, yeah. I don't have it yet, so.
Me neither. It's not me. We'll be right back.